This is the Dungeon Master Guys.
Hi, this is Phil, the chatty DM, welcoming you to our night show. I am with my friends, Dave. Hey, Dave, how you doing?
I'm great.
And with the newbie DM, how you doing, man?
Fantastic.
We'll have to start working on a new moniker for you, man. You're branching out.
You can be the newbie Dragon Master now.
We're called Game Masters in Dragon Age.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing. It's part of the, I think it's part of the GM DM's life of, you know, exploring beyond your first game or your first love, and then probably coming back, as I'm strongly thinking about lately. All right, so we've got a great show for you today. We've got Newbie, you sat down with Mike Shea to discuss combat speed in D&D 4E, which is a never everlasting discussion for many people. And Dave and I sat down with Margaret Weiss Productions designer Cam Banks to discuss one of our current favorite RPGs, Leverage. So I'm sure we'll have a great show, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it.
But first, let's hear a word from our sponsor, Obsidian Portal.
Too many NPCs to manage? Players can't remember what happened at the last session? Wasting valuable game time flipping through your notebook trying to find some detail you wrote down months ago? Running a tabletop campaign is hard, but Obsidian Portal makes it easy. With Obsidian Portal, you can manage your tabletop RPG campaign online. Our tools let you track NPCs, locations, items, events, and every other detail for your game. Sign up for free at obsidianportal.com and use promo code DMGUYS to get a bonus.
Using Obsidian Portal a lot lately because I am trying to keep it up to date with my new Dragon Age campaign. And I'm finding it very helpful uploading the maps and the... I've been building characters on it and a little bit of background on my story, so I'm finding it a very good tool. I tried to keep up an Obsidian Portal campaign when I was playing 4E, and I found it, I had a hard time keeping up, and my players wanted really to cooperate, so I'm really giving it my all this time with Dragon Age.
And there's no really issues by changing systems with that particular website, right?
No. It's pretty much a system.
It's generic.
System generic, yeah. System neutral, as they call it.
Cool. So, what was it that you talked about with Mike?
There's been a lot of talk lately in the blogosphere about combat speed and 4E D&D. And I wrote about it a little bit on my blog. Combat speed was one of the things that killed my 4E game. My players just sort of gave up on the hour-long combats. But I'm not going to get into that now. What I'm going to talk about is that Mike Shea, a lot of people know him as Sly Flourish online. He ran a 1 through 30 D&D campaign, 4E, and he's one of the top guys online to talk about 4E. And I asked him what some of his tools, some of the tools he had in his pocket were for speeding up combats in 4E. He's done it from the Heroic tier, Paragon, and Epic, and he knows all the tricks. So I wanted to get his advice on speeding up combat in 4E, and this is what he had to say. All right, I'm here with Mike Shea from the Sly Flourish blog. And Mike, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Mike, it's been on a lot of people's minds lately. It's been on a lot of blogs. I've seen it come up plenty of times. We're talking about combat speed in 4E.
Right.
There's a lot of people complaining about the pace of combat, how it's too slow, fights take too long. I felt it on my end, my group, talking about the same thing. And in fact, it cost me my 4E game. Mm-hmm. So I need to have this problem fixed. I need to get some ideas on how to make these things move faster. And I wanted to talk to you about it because I know you have some tricks up your sleeve for this. So
yeah,
what does Sly Flourish do at his house to try to make fights move a little quicker in 4E D&D?
Right. So, I mean, yeah, the 4E, you know, just natively, it has about probably about a minimum of an hour for combat. And that's just kind of the way the game works. So part of it is accepting the fact that battles are going to take a little bit of time. But I've seen battles take significantly longer than an hour, or I've seen battles that should have been shorter than an hour end up being an hour or more. And yeah, there have been a couple of things that I've run that I've tested over, you know, 50 or so games and really seen them work very well. Probably the first one is making sure that whatever initiative system you work, that is visible to everybody, you know, visible to both you as the DM and visible to all of the players. And that helps the players sort of police themselves. And there's always somebody at the table who's bored. And that bored person is going to look at the initiative list and say, you know, it's your turn to go. I know you've been talking about Angry Birds, but it's your turn to run. And that way, it's not just the DM who might be just as distracted as the players trying to make sure that things move smoothly. So I use the little folded card, you know, the folded sliced up 3x5 card over the DM screen as my method to see initiative on my side and let them see who the initiative on theirs. So that works really well. Probably the second one, which is something that's a little bit more recent for me, is the monster defense card. This is a little bit sacrilegious, but what I do is I now have a 5x8 index card that's folded in half that has the name of the monster and all four of the monster's defenses. And probably after about the first round or two, I'll have people rolling nature checks or arcana checks or religion checks to determine the defenses of the monster that they're fighting. And it usually doesn't take too many rolls before somebody rolls high, and then you throw the monster defense out there. And now everybody at the table can see what hits and what misses. And that reduces a lot of the back and forth between the DM and the player. You know, typically a player will say, you know, I rolled a 26, and you say, okay, versus what? And they'll say, well, versus fortitude. And you say, okay, which creature? And they'll say, that one over there. And you say, okay, what did you roll again? And they'll say, 26. And you said, okay, I think I got it. So there's a lot of back and forth. And now if someone's rolling, you know, getting ready before their turn, then they kind of roll their dice before their turn is up, which is, you know, can help. Now they can actually just say, yeah, I hit that guy over there for 14 damage. And you just write it down.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you realize that you've just divided, you've just polarized about 50% of the DMs listening out there. Whoa. That is sacrilegious, you know, letting players know the AC of the monster they're fighting and the defenses.
Yep.
Were your players really all cool with that, or were there?
Oh yeah, yeah. Nobody. I didn't have anybody that was upset about it. Nobody really seemed to be, you know, think that they shouldn't have it. And the thing is, you don't throw it out right away. You know, you want that the mystery of their defenses should be there for a little bit. They should have this idea. Wow, you know, I just missed on a. You know, I rolled a 14 and I missed, you know, or, oh, this guy's fortitude is really rough because I just rolled a high fortitude and it missed. So you still want that, but you don't, you know, when you get into like round three or four, they don't care anymore. And most of the time they've rolled so many different attack rolls against that guy that they have a pretty good gauge anyway. Like anybody that was paying attention could narrow the range. So at that point, you can just throw it on the table and make it available to everybody. And no, I don't have any real strong storyteller role player types at my game. Most of them are pretty tactical. They just like to watch the battle run and they like to roll their dice and have a good time. So to display the defenses for them wasn't really that big a deal. You know, they didn't feel like they were getting super secret knowledge, and it really helped them out. So no, it didn't end up being any kind of problem. And I know I've gotten some criticism from people that say that you're pulling back the curtain too far, but I don't think so. I'm pretty happy with it.
Let me ask you something. 4E, from its inception, has been known as a game that wanted to sort of evolve the battlegrounds, if you will. They wanted big set pieces, big environmental effects, big obstacles in the way, difficult terrain, that sort of thing. What do you do as far as the place, you know, the location of the battle for the sake of speed?
I'm pretty happy with in using heavy if I want a fast battle, there are times where the big set piece battle is not exactly what I want, and I want something a little faster than that. I like big sets, and my players certainly like big sets. They like those giant battle maps that came with the old D&D adventures and are coming in some of the newer D&D adventures where they can really run around a big space. But every so often, you just want to have a small little skirmish. You just want something where that's part of the story, and you kind of want them to feel, you know, that they're not just going from the doorway of the dungeon all the way to the boss's lair. You want something in the middle. And one trick that I have is heavy environmental effects, that you can have a room where the monsters are there, but the monsters aren't the real threat. The real threat is an escalating environmental effect. So, you know, not to talk about my game, but I had one where a room was filling up very quickly with this poisonous blood that was, you know, very soon going to fill up the entire room. And there were four battle whites that the party had to fight. And at first they thought the battle whites are the real problem. But it turned out that the battle whites weren't the problem. The problem was that the room is filling with blood and they're taking, you know, 10 necrotic damage every round, and it's escalating every round. So the next round is 20, the next round is 30. And they need to deal with that instead of the monsters. So that actually sped things up because the fight against the monsters wasn't really what what was going on. It was dealing with the environmental effect, and skill challenges and things like that are generally faster than battles are. So they beat down the whites without too much difficulty, and then they had to deal with the environmental effect. So it sped up the game, but it still gave them a pretty heavy threat. They were still pretty worried about what was going to happen. So one I've been trying out, and it works pretty well. It's another one that's a little bit sacrilegious. Is I'll actually, this is something I've only been doing for the past couple of games, is picking somebody else at the table and having them track monster damage. So instead of me recording down the amount of damage that a monster is taking, one of the other players who's, you know, generally pretty, you know, has a pretty good handle on running their own character, can also just keep track of damage, and they're getting used to it. You know, sometimes they'll forget the fact that they're the one that's recording monster damage, so they're not paying attention, and I'll have to kind of route it to them. But from the DM's perspective, it means, and when you mix it with the monster cards and the initiative, it means the only thing I really have to handle is monster strategy on their turn. So it really helps me kind of focus on the rest of the game and focus on what the players are seeing and how they're acting and whether or not they're interested in what's going on or not, instead of having to constantly worry about tracking this monster damage like a stockbroker in Wall Street.
Yeah, I think having your players at the table help you out with tracking conditions and hit points and stuff like that is a fundamental part of speeding up combat. I know I did it in my game. It was necessary. I had 7 people.
Yeah.
So it was necessary to have, you know, a little bit of help at the table.
Yeah, that's rough. I mean, you know, any amount of players higher than 5 is going to be hard to manage. It's going to be hard to manage just in time, and it's also going to be really hard to manage in trying to scale a battle and make sure the battle's still challenging.
Well, you know, it affected the way I planned my game, because the way I was prepping 4E, I would take a look at the players that were going to show up for a particular week, and if I had a full house, we were talking 7 players, and I would say, well, I got 7 players, I have 3 hours to play. So yeah, it looks like I'm going to fit one battle and a little bit of role playing and a little bit of exploration, and that's about it.
Right.
So I wouldn't bother prepping anything else, because I knew it was all for nothing.
Yeah, and the problem is, I mean, any battle that you're going to run that's going to challenge 7 players is going to have, you know, 9 monsters, because the way players scale in power is greater than a linear path, you know.
Yep.
If you had a 6 player or a 6 PC, that's not adding a 6 monster, that's adding 2 more monsters. If you had a 7th, it's even worse. Like, if you have 2 leaders, you'll never kill them. So, you know, you'll never really damage them, and they'll never really feel threatened, which means your whole battle is going to get longer. So you're back to square one. Again, I think when you have more than 5 players, though, when you add these kind of scaling environmental effects, where maybe it's, you know, 15 poison damage that grows by 5 every round, you know, everybody's going to feel that, and it doesn't take any extra time for them to realize that on the beginning of their turn, they're going to take 25 poison damage. And, you know, the leaders are going to have to really scramble, and the players are going to have to scramble to figure out whatever they need to figure out in order to stop that from happening.
All right, Mike, I think one important thing you said at the top, and you know, I'll say it here again, is that if you're playing 4E, you have to assume that the fights are not going to be over in 10 minutes.
Right.
And for, you know, you have to determine, is your group really interested in a shorter fight? Because they may not be. They may enjoy the long tactical combats.
Right.
And if that's what your group is into, then so be it. And have fun with it and fight till your, you know, till your heart's content.
Yep. Some groups, it really has to be an agreement.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know what you're getting into when you're playing 4E. You're playing a highly tactical, you know, D&D, where fights are going to take a little longer.
Right. And a lot of people like it.
A lot of people will like it, and if you're finding that you're having a tough time with it and you're not really enjoying it, then, you know, you may want to explore something else.
Yep.
That's just the sad truth. All right, Mike, thank you for coming on the Dungeon Master Guys podcast.
Yep, anytime.
You know, we love having you here. Take care.
Always a pleasure. Bye.
So, as you heard in the interview, he talks about putting monster defenses on the table, and I that's one thing that you're either in the for camp or the against camp. How do you guys feel about that?
I'm hesitant. I know that Mike gets that answer a lot from a lot of people, because it does seem kind of radical. In some ways, you know, when you play through a combat, you know, if you have players that are number crunchers at all, they're going to figure out the defenses by a certain point anyway. So it does sort of cut to the chase there. But I do kind of like that process of discovery. So there might be kind of a middle ground where, you know, the players can spend some time like assessing the monsters, making skill checks, and then maybe reveal them. But putting them directly out on the table, I'm not sure I'm ready for yet.
on my side, I'm pretty much for it, 100% for it. I actually couldn't care less about keeping the numbers a mystery for monsters. I don't have a head for numbers when I DM. I usually want to focus more about on the story or the action going on or making the players look good by, you know, fueling their ideas and whatnot. So for me, putting the numbers on the table is, well, as I said, it's easier, but it also goes with a recent shift in my thinking about, you know, always put your cards on the table about whatever feat the players want to attempt so that they know up before they start rolling their dice what they're up against. It's part of the tension from, I believe that it's part of the tension. They know what they're gunning for and they know what's going to happen if they succeed or fail. It also helps define how other players can help.
I think combat speed and 4E is one of those things that's going to be talked about throughout the duration of the game, but I don't think there's really much that Wizards of the Coast can do about it, short of introducing new rules, which I don't really think they would want to do to the game anyways.
At least not at this point.
Can I be quasi-edition worry here?
Sure.
I had way longer combats in 3rd edition as the levels got higher.
Oh, God. I remember.
Yeah, I have some horror stories that have just never come up. And the big thing for me is that even if the combats do on average take longer, especially at those lower levels, I mean, no question, like 3rd edition era combats, you know, lower levels were way quicker. But I feel like the time we're spending, you know, even if it is like analyzing all your tactical options or choosing between powers, is way different than all the times that somebody like would, you know, cast a buff spell which on somebody else, which would cause them to recalculate something, which means they'd have to go to the book and figure out, okay, what's this based off of so that I can figure out my spell DC or, you know, spell resistance or this, that, and the other. And it's just such a, for me, you know, and obviously your games vary and there are ways to speed that stuff up too, but for me, like, I prefer, you know, having long combats because people are making interesting decisions than having to look stuff up or recalculate stuff.
But I think that, I agree with you. I've been playing the modern versions of D&D for the last, 12 years now, 13 years. But I think the issue is not so much the system. It's the fact that most of the players that we talk about it online are 10 years older than they used to be when they started playing it. And their time that they're willing to invest in it has seriously shrunk. So 12 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when we were playing 3rd edition, yes, the combats were pretty long, but we could probably put 6 or 7 hours in it, or it was easier. But anyway, yes, it's going to be like Game Fiend says over at Will. It's for many, combat length is a feature; it's not a bug.
Yeah. I think it's hard to pin down for every group, you know, why is it taking so long? There are a number of factors, but I also think you're right. I mean, I was a senior in high school when 3rd edition came out, so my gaming situation now is way different.
I think I was starting my first job after my master's degree when it came out. But yeah, we still had more time. But that being said, speaking of one of the things that I've been looking for in a role-playing game now was faster gameplay, not so much in the fact that we want less crunch or less rules to manipulate how it goes at the table, but I want to spend more time on significant story points and progress more in a story in a given role-playing game. And I've been seeing more of that than some of the games I've been experiencing. And one of those games has been Leverage. As I think Dave and I, well, I'm pretty sure Dave likes it as much as I do, or if not more. Our experiences with it so far have been very positive, right, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I've been hacking it. I've been running games of it when I can. I've been running online. I've been thinking about lifting huge parts of the system and attaching them to D&D. You might say that I'm a fan, you know.
Yeah, and it's the same here. So that's that leads us to the discussion we had when we talked to Cam Banks from Margaret Weiss Production, who did a lot of work. I think it was lead design on the Leverage role-playing game, which is based on a role-playing system called Cortex Plus. So let's listen to what Cam had to say to us. All right, we're here with Cam Banks, author of many of the Dragonlance role-playing books with Margaret Weiss Production. He's also worked on several other products like the Smallville role-playing game. He's done a few books in the Supernatural and what was the older lines? Smallville role-playing game. And he lately he's been working on the Leverage role-playing game, which just came out, right?
That's right. Well, it came out in PDF last year, but the books are hitting the shelves now.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of people excited on the web. So I thought that Dave and I could discuss with Cam a little bit about the Leverage role-playing game and the Cortex Plus systems behind it. So, Cam, why don't you tell us a little bit about it, of the story that led from the original Cortex game that I think powered games like Battlestar Galactica and Serenity, that led to the next version of the game, Cortex Plus, which, unless I'm wrong, powers Smallville and Leverage.
That's right. Yep. The story of Cortex goes a long way back, actually. It goes back to the Sovereign Stone role-playing game that came out many years ago. Sovereign Stone was very much like the way that Cortex works. It had dice for traits. It was very much a kind of a game where you roll a bunch of dice to get the different sizes and compare them to things. So the Sovereign Stone was one of those settings that became a D20 product. Eventually, they converted it over from the original unique system it had to a D20 game. And when the Serenity license was picked up by Margaret Weiss Productions, they dug out Sovereign Stone's system, and the choice was whether we would go with D20 for Serenity, which was one option, or whether we would take the Sovereign Stone game and kind of tweak that a bit and make that the basic rules for Serenity. And at the time, it wasn't called anything. It was just a Serenity role-playing game system. But when the Battlestar Galactica license was acquired and we moved forward with other games, we called it Cortex to name. We named it after the, you know, the internets in the Firefly universe. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And then after a while, each time we put a new game out, we tweaked it a bit more. And finally, after some soul searching and some just some thinking about how to do these things best and feedback from some of our fans, we decided that rather than having each game just be the sort of a generic system with the license put on top of it, which is what had kind of been happening for a while, we would instead move forward and have the system directly support the genre and the license that it was going to be attached to. So in the course of doing that, also I threw some changes and tweaks into it again, and so we called it Cortex Plus to separate it from the classic Cortex, which is the one that's used in Supernatural and games before it.
Dave, did you play both the original Cortex and the Cortex Plus games?
I played a session of Serenity. That was about the extent of it.
And you played Leverage too, right?
Yes, I played a bunch of Leverage now.
And how would you say that both games compare?
I definitely prefer the implementation of Leverage, although, you know, it's clearly, you know, like a stepping stone thing. Yes, Cam, you can talk about this better than I can, but some of the things in Cortex Plus really kind of give fuel to GMs running it rather than making it just, you know, kind of a standard, like kind of what you think of as a traditional role-playing game, quote-unquote, where, you know, someone comes up with the entire plot. There's actually a lot in Cortex Plus that helps power the game itself. Could you talk about that a little bit? Like, you know, what kind of design went into that? And, you know, was that a goal? That kind of thing.
Well, it kind of goes back to thinking about what the license needs to have to make it work right. In order for the license to really work, we had to, well, I was thinking very early on in concept stage that the game's going to have to be a lot different. The one that started things off was Smallville, because I wanted to think about a game where you could play Clark Kent as well as Lois Lane and not have the person playing Lois feel like there was no point in even being there at the table, because Clark could just, you know, punch a guy into next week or race around the world in 20 seconds or something like that. So thinking about the license is the first step, and the second thing we had to do was find, you know, ways to really just change the way the system responded in play. Smallville, it's a game that was very much influenced by soap opera styles. You had to focus on relationships and what things meant to you, and rather than have it be about, you know, action physics, as they call it, I've saw that lately, action physics games with stats and skills and things. Smallville had to be a lot more about the kind of meta level thinking. So that was a kind of a balancing act. You know, you could make it more equal for the players at the table if what they were really concerned with was how they thought about things and what, you know, was driving them to do the things they did. And Leverage was similarly, we had to think about the whole holy grail of heist games and capers, and how do you do that without seeming completely fake or something else? And that was a really long discussion I had with Rob Donahue, who was my co-writer for the Leverage rule set. So he's an amazingly bright guy, obviously, if you've read anything that he's done before. And I think that was an opportunity for him to really flex his ideas about how to do games where you involve flashbacks. How do you do games where you don't know all the answers going in? So what you were saying, Dave, I think about this whole approach of not having the whole plot, that's really crucial to Leverage. You know, we know who the mark is, we know who the client is, and we have some idea of the locations and some stuff like that. But there's no plan to start with unless you have it's like a convention game. We often have a plan in place. But if you're playing in your own house and you've made the game from scratch, you don't have the time to sit there and prep for it. You know, it has to come down to the players. Or, as you may see in the book, there's a huge chunk of random charts that you can roll on. That also helps, too.
The game I've played with Dave was based on one of those charts, right?
Yeah. That's one of the things I was really impressed with, was you could just take those charts and just roll up a job, you know, and instead of needing, like, it wasn't even, I was planning the plot of the game that I was going to run, you know, I was just able to take those charts, roll on them, and then turn that into, okay, here's the setup, and then, you know, put it on the players to decide how they wanted to approach it. But it wasn't in a way where it, you know, Phil, you played in that game, you know, I don't feel like it, you know.
I mean, it didn't feel improvised, it felt natural. I mean, it was complete with the fact that, you know, the client showed up, we had an idea who the bad guy was, and, I mean, our characters were ready to, you know, to hit the ground running from the start. It was really, really amazing.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that's kind of, it generates a situation for you, but the plan and how to go about doing things to solve it, that's where the players can really feel that they're smart. I mean, they've got these cool plans. Most of the time, the stuff they do in the game is going to succeed. You know, the game was designed for
a for team success.
It's not a game where you fail all the time. It's that wouldn't really reflect the show.
Why don't we talk about complications and plot points as possible things to take to other games?
Yeah.
Or right. Or like, what do you feel those mechanics do? Like, how do those help a game run, basically?
One of the things that changed with Cortex Plus was that although we had plot points before in the game, they were a little bit more like, what's a good comparison, like the Bennies from Savage Worlds, where, you know, I spend a point and I get a bonus. Mm-hmm. It was more like that. There's been many games before that have had that, you know, I have a point to make my dice roll better.
Yeah.
I think the one game system that really took that to a point where it was different, it had a whole lot more to do with maybe thinking about the fiction of the story, was Fate, the Spirit of the Century. So aspects were obviously an influence on many people. And no surprise, Leverage has got Fred and Rob and those guys from Evil Hat have contributed to the game. But it's a little bit different from that. The way that aspects work is not the same as how assets and complications and plot points work in Cortex Plus. So I think there's a nice new thing you can take away from the game if you look at those and how they work together.
Well, just for those who never actually read Leverage yet or haven't read it yet, can you just give us an overview of what plot points are for and what are the assets and complications and opportunities of the game?
Okay. The plot points, the main reason to use them is to give yourself some extra dice to roll in your actions.
So you can hit your target.
Yeah. Well, what really happens is you get to get a better chance of hitting your target, because no matter how many dice you roll, you keep the two highest and you add them together to get a result.
Yeah.
So the chance of getting really good result, you know, is increased if you roll, say, 8 dice as opposed to 2, because of the way that statistics work. It's very pretty. You can also spend plot points to add an additional dice to the result beyond just having the two that you keep. You can use the plot points to activate certain things in your character sheet that are triggered by using plot points. There are talents and leverage. Many of them, you have to spend a plot point to use them, and a talent is kind of a special shtick, a thing that you can do that other characters don't necessarily know how to do. And so that's the purpose of plot points. You can also use them to try and introduce new elements into the story by saying, well, is there a TV set here tuned into the room next door with a closed circuit TV? Well, yes, there is, because there's been a plot point. There we go, scene editing. And then we make that even more mechanical by saying, well, when you make those things, you get a thing called an asset, which is that thing, like closed circuit TV, and then it's D6. And you can use that as a die. You can roll it into things when that might help you succeed or whatever.
And
so
just allow me, and that's a particular point where players can get really creative, because all the players around the table can look at themselves and say, look, what could we exploit right now that would make sense in this story?
Right. Yeah, I love the story that someone told about when they were playing through the Quick Start job, which was our intro product for Leverage that came out early last year. The player who was controlling Elliot, the hitter, he spent 2 points. He got 1 point for a bottle of wine and another point for a wine glass, and he used them in the fight with some mooks. He took them out with a wine.
Oh, nice.
Turned around, spun around, and threw a bottle at someone after pouring himself some wine, took a sip of that, threw it at somebody else. And, there's no reason why you couldn't have had it be baseball bat, D6, but it was just cool to have him bring that into the story. And that's kind of where that, like you were saying, that player input really shines, right? So now, as well as those assets, which are cool to have, it's nice to spend points to get things I can roll and to make myself do well. The one thing that changed from Classic Cortex to Cortex Plus that involves plot points was that before, the way you got them was by playing your character in negative ways in line with sort of like a drawback feature mm-hmm. of your character. Like, I'm going to be a drunk, so I will get some points for being drunk. To hard code that a bit more, Leverage uses that in the distinctions, where you can get a D8 bonus for something like drunk if it's going to help you, and then you get a D4 and a plot point if it's going to hinder you. And that was a revelation thing that Rob came up with, because he didn't want anyone to be penalized for anything.
Yep.
And I agreed. I think you can't take things away from you if it's leveraged, because you're too badass, Mm-hmm. So the D4, the problem is that, and this is the leads into the next part of this, is that anytime you roll a 1 on a die in your action pool, when you roll the dice and one comes up a 1 or more, one or more dice come up 1s, those, first of all, don't add into your result at all.
That's what I forgot from running the quick start yesterday.
Yeah, you don't get to add those 1s in. So if you had a 6 and a 1, you just get 6. But the second thing is, the guy running the game, the fixer is what the GMs call him, Leverage, he can buy that from you and say, okay, I'm going to give you a plot point. Here you go. But I'm having a complication. And a complication, something has gone wrong. And you get to name that. You describe it like, building on fire, or guards are suspicious, or something that could potentially make things difficult for the players. Yeah. And then he gets to roll those dice in on his rolls when he's opposing you.
For example, yesterday I used complication to say one of the thugs that were sitting down in the bank, I'd seen Elliot somewhere before. So I wrote, did I see you somewhere before D6?
Yeah. And, of course, the more ones you roll, you can add it. Steps to that. So, like, if you roll 3 ones, I can give you 3 plot points and have a D10 instead of a D6.
Ooh, okay.
Or I could have multiple D6.
That's one of the things that I really like about it, is that instead of having to say, like, look up a rule that says, okay, here's what a building on fire means, or
yeah.
I can write anything on a complication. The die value tells how serious it is, or you know, how potential of an obstacle it is, but, you know, like, I can have an angry scowl be a card or a building on fire or the wine glass or whatever, all just sort of represented the same way, you know.
Yeah.
It all works the same way in the rules. I don't have to look anything up, but it covers such wide ground that it makes it a lot easier to run.
And it's seamless. I mean, the players don't mind it. They don't. The action goes so fast that it all seamlessly goes into whatever dice pool you use. You throw all your dice, and it the action never stops. It's really cool for that.
Yeah. So I mean, this is kind of almost self-contained little currency flow system that goes back and forth. Players spend the plot points, and they get them from when they roll very badly on their dice. But they also get them from other situations too, like I said, with the distinction, if you really think that. And the fixer doesn't make that decision. That's one thing that's different from, say, with Fate, where you have compels, where the GM in the Fate game says, well, you know, I'm spending a point, do you do this? You know, play your character towards the negative. In this case, player control is totally in the hands of the player. You know, if you want drunk to be a problem for you, you're the one who decides that. So that's an interesting thing. I mean, some people were saying, when am I ever going to do that? Why would I make myself have that thing? Well, first of all, you want to get the plot point from that.
Yeah.
Second, when you roll a d4, there's a much better chance that you're going to get a 1 than you will get a 1 on the d6 or d8 or d10. So all the d4s in your pool of dice that you're rolling have a 1-4 chance of getting a complication, which means you get even more plot points. So it's kind of a self-sustaining little engine.
Yeah. In one of the games I ran a bit, I remember one of the characters had Tristadecaphobia as one of his distinctions. And so he's going in to confront the mark at a football game. And he said, okay, well, as I'm trying to get in there, you know, he's like talking his way past the guards. He said, I look over and I see that the score is tied 13-13. And he was able to, like, bring in this awesome, you know, like, character moment that worked off of that. But it was also him building up plot points for his confrontation with the mark, you know, directly. So it was both, like, an awesome character moment, and it was, like, a good strategic play at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's something that will take getting used to if you haven't done it before. And I think there are a lot of people who were playing Smallville for 2 or 3 sessions similarly and wondering why. It felt like they were always having to give in and lose, and it's just because, you know, you want to do that sort of stuff in Smallville. In Leverage, you want to make your life complicated because it helps you out.
Yeah, but it's another. I think Leverage is another of those games where players eventually learn that failures are not so bad because they'll never lead to dead ends in the story.
Right.
They'll just lead to more complications, or you'll have to, you know, work harder to get out of whatever hole you dug yourself in.
Well, I also, I mean, looking at the show that it's based on and many other high action stuff, very, very rarely does anyone get shot and killed in a horrible way if they're the main character. You know, it's just not going to happen. And you can get beaten up and stuff, but I didn't think we needed to have a system where you had hit points and wounds that tracked. Because, you know, Elliot might have just come out of a fight where he was engaged with, like, 9 different people with lengths of lead pipe, you know. And maybe he's all bruised and beaten up, but unless he's got a complication that's called bruised and beaten up, it's not going to stop him or get in the way or anything else. It's just part of the story, you know. It's not really affecting his performance. And I think that was essential. I don't want to have a game like Leverage where the person playing the hitter is always sitting on 2 hit points and worried they're going to get taken out. It doesn't really fit the style.
Yep.
Cool.
Okay, so I guess our last question. What's next for Cortex and Margaret Weiss Productions?
Well, I hear there's a game that might have you two both working on it.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. At this point, what I'm going to say is that we have an upcoming fantasy swashbuckling RPG based on some books that Margaret and her friend Robert Crams have been writing. And it's going to be fantasy. It's going to have intrigue and airships and pirates and the church and other kinds of cool stuff. And it's a Cortex Plus game. And we also have both of you are working on this with us. So that's really awesome.
Yes, it's going to be such a great project.
And there'll be more information and updates about that, I guess, later on. But yeah, I mean, that's one thing. There's a couple other things we're pursuing. Now that we've got these other games under our belt and trying to explore new ways to bring Cortex Plus out there, there's another thing which I'm going to be doing very soon. It's collecting some submissions from people to contribute to what amounts to being an anthology of hacks for Cortex Plus. And we'll be getting people, anyone from who's a fan of our games or industry-type, designer-type person might want to contribute. So eventually they'll come together to be this sort of collection of articles and advice and theory and so forth. And I think it's going to be called the Cortex System Hacker's Guide. So it won't be a generic source book kind of basic rule book. It'll be useful for people who've already got one of our games who wants to take it and hack the heck out of it. So that's kind of what I'm planning on for this near future.
Yeah, and it's a very hack-friendly game, so I'm pretty sure it's going to be a very popular book. Good idea.
Yeah, it sounds right. Very cool. And as you guys know, I've got my own hack that I've been working on for
which is so cool. I just, yeah. I regret that I wasn't able to try it out over the holiday break.
Yeah, I should be able to try it out soon, which I'm pretty excited about. And at the same time, after I ran Leverage for some of the guys in my regular gaming group, you know, two of them were like, oh, you could also do this, you know, this other book. You could totally do that with the system. And so, you know, like, people I'm around and playing games with are also getting their own ideas for hacks just by playing. So it's definitely a very hack-friendly system.
Well, thank you very much, Cam, for being with us today. This was Cam Banks, game designer who's worked on the Leverage role-playing game, and he was very nice enough to show up and talk to us for a few minutes. Thanks.
Hey,
Cam, thank you very much.
It's good to have the funny accents together at last.
Yeah.
So that was our talk with Cam Banks of Margaret Weiss Productions. Talking about, you know, some of the things that we enjoy about Leverage and how that can help DMs. And, you know, there's some important stuff in there at the end, too.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's pretty cool. We're actually going to be working on the next product for Margaret Weiss Production, and I'm very excited of doing writing and working on that particular game. If only we could talk more about it. But, hey, we'll need to be patient and wait until Gen Con. So, but for now, we'll just stick to saying that it's a swashbuckling role-playing game with lots of action.
I want to ask you guys, how much do you need to know about the shows that these games are based on to play them properly? Or can Leverage just be run without having any like, I've never seen the show, for example.
I played it once with Dave, and prior knowledge is not necessary at all. I mean, it helps because in certain scenes, you will ask GM, am I allowed to do it? And the player will pop in, oh, I see this in the show all the time. Which can actually help, but I don't think it's necessary.
You know what's funny? This is kind of like the rebirth of the IP game systems. Like, all these popular game systems now are attached to a property instead of being generic. You know, there's the Leverage, there's the Smallville, there's the Dragon Age. They're all kind of making noise, and they're all attached to a pre-existing property. It's kind of cool.
Yes, yes, but they go...
Files.
Yeah, but they go beyond. Yeah, they go beyond the IP because it's the actual show or work they're based on is just like a starter for what you can do with the game. You can go so much beyond, and you can break canon without even, you know, breaking a sweat actually. And the game is even more enjoyable when you start creating your own stuff. All right, so those were the segments that we were covering on this particular show, but I do believe we had an email since the last show that would be very interesting to discuss. So, Dave, can you give us the details?
Yeah, we got an email from Ryan about one of my favorite subjects, one of my favorite pet peeves about skill checks. So he says that he's wondering about shared knowledge, about people rolling, say, a religion check to get information, and, you know, you've got six people in the party. They're all rolling, you know, chances are one of them is going to succeed, you know, because, like, the odds are all skewed up. And then, of course, the one, like, the DM is just saying, okay, here's what you remember, you know, from your religion check, and then everyone hears it. So it kind of defeats the point of, you know, some of those people rolling or people being trained, kind of dilutes the whole thing, you know. And so he's just wondering, you know, how do you tackle that sort of thing? Is there any, you know, would it be good if someone rolls poorly, if they actually penalize the attempt, that kind of thing, how to make your shared knowledge work out for the party?
Well, I think that the starting point of that discussion would be whatever D20 role-playing game you're playing right now. Whatever game that means roll a D and try to beat a number would be to start with 4E's helping rule, which basically means that you need to hit a, you know, average DC or an easy DC. I don't know how it works. I think it's, what, 10 plus half your level now. Whenever you help someone, and then if you fail at helping, you actually give them a penalty, which I think is a good starting point. There should be a price to actually help or roll for a skill check that usually experts should be the ones doing the roll. That should start the discussion. Now, I don't know how you guys are tackling it or are thinking about tackling it. Newbie, what do you do when, you know, everybody wants to jump in on a given roll or knowledge checks, which are they shared or not?
At my table, I'm going to be straight up very honest with you guys. My players are not going to role play that strictly. Once somebody guesses it, or once somebody gains the knowledge, or once somebody figures something out, he immediately says, I share it with the rest of the party. Boom.
So it's a core assumption of your game's consensus.
It's a core assumption that everybody will know everything. When somebody figures something out, everybody will know.
Well, that's usually part of what I call an informal social contract, and it's fine. It works for many people.
But yeah, but there's times when you're DMing when you don't want that to happen, and it's very hard to change, especially older players. It's very hard to change habits and teaching old dogs new tricks.
What about you?
It's got the same problem too, because my games have tended to be the same way, where whoever succeeds is going to share the information. You know, we always joke, oh, I'm just going to keep that to myself, but you know, it never actually happens. And of course, people would have to metagame, or they have to avoid metagaming that they know the knowledge, blah 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 blah. But it's the same core problem where you still got that many people rolling, you know, which means that most skill checks are going to be successful, you know, which kind of defeats the point of having the DCs there in the first place. My recommendations tend to be, I think the assist other being risky is an important rule. Also, you have to justify how you're assisting is another thing. You know, you might just uniformly bump up skill checks, you know, across the board to compensate for the fact that people are probably going to be attempting multiple things. At the same time, you also, you don't want to penalize the people who have put their points or whatever. So one system I propose is actually you just take the number of people who are trained in a skill and you give them different levels of information based on, you know,
their
how
actual,
many people are trained.
Their actual numbers.
Yep. All you right. Say, okay, there are three people trained in the party. I'm giving you three pieces of information about this. And if you want a fourth or a fifth, those other people can roll, but the people who are trained automatically get stuff, you know. It doesn't address the problem of, you know, sharing the knowledge if you want some stuff to be secret. But if you have a group that's very set on sharing anything anyway, that kind of speeds it up. And, you know, it means you can break out the information a bit more, where instead of just saying, okay, if anyone hits 15, you see this, you can say, well, here are the different levels of success. And that's based on, you know, whatever the role is or however many people are trained or whatever system you want to tackle.
Back in the day, we used to get a piece of paper, crumple it up and throw it across the table to a player who figured something out, or, you know, or a couple of players, and passing notes around the table wasn't uncommon. And I don't know, at least in my gaming group over time, that sort of died out. And it isn't being done anymore. But I think I may bring that back to my Dragon Age game.
Yeah, my personal approach on it is directly based with the article I wrote a few days ago, is especially for knowledge check, I would basically ask the group if they want to collaborate on it or not. And if they do, I'll ask for a leader, probably the most skilled person on it, saying that he's going to drive whatever montage of research, if they're doing research in the city, or whatever discussions they're having in the field to try to remember stuff. And then everybody else I would ask to describe how they're going to help with their own skills or their own powers or their own, you know, bardic checks and whatnot. And from all of this, I would have just one role, which would go for the chain for this, the actual skill. Then everybody else would get another a role for helping if they want. And now if your group does not want to share, that would basically be played according to those mechanics I've been using as refusing help. So if you refuse someone else's help, you're basically saying, oh, I don't really want, and I'm not going to share what I'm going to find. So that would be one of the approaches I would look into. And if another player really, really, really wants to go after it, well, unless I guess you could have, you know, parallel rolling, but then I'd have a discussion about how the group wants to play.
Yeah, and at the same time, you could even argue that a lot of RPGs, especially D&D, have moved towards a model where all that stuff is, it's encouraged that everyone is working as a team. Everyone would put their cards on the table, and so you don't have the one kind of loner who doesn't cooperate, so that you always have to pass some secret notes, that games are actually pushing people in that direction anyway. So that might have something to do with it, too.
Yeah. But in that particular case, if that's the assumption, I think we all agree on here, having the whole table roll because they know that someone's going to roll a 20 is insane. And it steals the thunder from the player that actually invested the points and effort to get the skill at the highest level.
Yeah, it's so hard to stop players from doing that behavior. I mean, I've seriously tried lately, but first guy has the idea, oh, I want to search the room. Okay, roll a perception check. Oh, I rolled a 13. And then, like, all of the five people are like, oh, yeah, I'm going to search the room, too, Because in many cases...
Then I go and say, who takes the lead? And who's helping the leader? And they'll usually all default to the guy with the highest one.
You're right, but that's still sort of the same effect.
And yeah, the one difference I might not have said is if they do fail their search check, is the search check significant in the adventure? But if they do fail their search check, I would use Luke Crane's Let It Ride rule and says, nope, no, you don't find anything, moving on.
Right, but then in that specific circumstance, you've got a couple issues. First of all, the people who have the idea are less likely to speak up if they don't have the good skill roll, it's rewarding playing the numbers on your sheet versus, mm-hmm. acting on a good idea. And at the same time, it's hard to explain to players this person already said they didn't find anything, but you guys are convinced he's an idiot, but you can't roll anyway,
Well, they could have helped. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's never as simple as it looks on paper. But my system is brilliant.
Yeah. Of course. I mean, the big thing is there's no opportunity cost in D&D for rolling skill checks, really. And I think when it comes down to it, that's sort of the problem,
Short of making all skill checks drained, which kind of rubs up the heroic feeling of the game.
Yeah, or saying that, on any kind of failure... something is introduced, which, tying it back to our last segment, something I like about leverage is that you actually have several possibilities on every skill check, including just straight up success, just straight up failure, which tends to be D&D, or failure but with some complications, or success with some complications. So, the more dice you're rolling and the more help you're getting, the more chance there is to introduce complications because there's more balls in the air, you could say. D&D doesn't have that kind of thing, but that's the sort of thing, if you could figure out how to introduce it, yes, you all can roll to search as well, but you have a higher chance of introducing all these complications.
Yes.
And that might be another way to go.
Dragon Age has a similar thing, but not really for complications, but more for degree of success. Because when you take a skill check in Dragon Age, or you do what they call a test, there's not really skills really in Dragon Age, but when you do a test based off of your abilities, the higher you roll in the dragon die, the better the degree of success is, and the lower you roll, then the worse it is.
And I assume that the rules give guidelines as to how to evaluate degrees of success.
They give guidelines, very minor ones. There's a lot of GM fiat in that game.
Yeah,
they don't really get too involved in stuff that you should be coming up with on your own.
Which is a design decision, I'm sure. All right, so this has been a very interesting and lively show. There are some aspects of those discussions that we can speak forever and make this a 4-hour long show, but we need to conclude. So once again, you can send us questions or phone us or send us email at what contact info, please?
305-349-3026. 305-349-3026. Make sure to state it's for the DM Guys podcast.
Or send us an email at dmg@critical-hits.com or go to the dmguys.net and leave a comment on the show notes.
I want to once again thank our sponsor, Obsidian Portal, and I want to thank you for listening to us for ninth show. We're almost around the clock with two more and we'll have it done a full year. It's still very exciting. It's still very interesting. So I hope you enjoyed as much as we enjoyed making it for you. So Dave, newbie, see you next month.